Welcome to Behind the Headlines. This week on the program, Utah officials rebuke racist statements from Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, the cattle rancher who's refused to pay federal grazing fees. How will his bad behavior affect the Tea Party? A new report slams former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff for allegedly giving a sweetheart deal to a convicted fraudster. How will the report be used by criminal investigators? Political delegates get ready to choose their slate of candidates at party conventions this weekend. Who are the best bets? And the University of Utah says the family affected by a sperm switch at its fertility clinic deserves an apology. Is that enough for the family? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, action-packed, we've got sperm, we've got Shurtleff, we've got Cliven Bundy, and many more stories. We'll see how much we can get to. Joining me this morning, Tribune sports reporter Matt Piper. Good morning, Matt.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, government and politics editor Dan Harry. Dan, hi there.
Morning.
And editorial writer George Pyle. George, welcome.
How are you?
I'm great. And you can join us too. What headlines grabbed you this week? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on our website, sltrib.com. You can call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to talk about the man of the week, Cliven Bundy. He, of course, is the Nevada cattle rancher who put off paying grazing fees for a couple of decades, and he ended up in an armed standoff with the feds. They, of course, backed off, but he's continued to make some pretty appalling comments. And Dan Harry, what's he saying?
Well, the big news today is the racially charged comments that were reported in the New York Times, where he was, brainstorming out loud to himself.
Sure.
And talked about how, as in his words, the Negro perhaps may have been better off under slavery. It's the reaction to that's been pretty swift and universal. And Mr. Bundy, I think, has a lot fewer supporters today than he did a couple of days ago.
Hmm. The reaction from conservatives nationally, of course, has been out there. But we heard from some of our top officials here in this state. What is Governor Herbert saying about this?
Well, Governor Herbert's comment was that he doesn't believe that Cliven Bundy is the face for the fight over public lands. And, you know, that goes beyond the racial comment. I think that Herbert and Representative Rob Bishop, particularly those two, have really been trying for months behind the scenes to reach a compromise, a grand bargain, as they sometimes call it, about public lands and management and control of those in Utah. They haven't really struck any deals yet, but they keep thinking that that's going to happen. And they see this kind of confrontation, especially when you have armed people on both sides of the line, as very counterproductive to that effort. Mm. So
Bundy is certainly not the only one out there fed up with the feds. The tensions have been brewing throughout the West. Here in Utah, we see them in Iron County, in San Juan County. Update us on some of those flashpoints here in Utah.
Yeah, so one that's coming up here is on May 8th, where the San Juan County Commissioner, I think his name is Philip Lyman, has vowed to lead a unauthorized tour of ATVs up Recapture Canyon, and that's a protected area mainly because of the artifacts protected resources up there. And they're have announced that they're going to lead this ride up there. So, you know, it's another opportunity for a confrontation of the type we've seen. And really, I think a lot of the folks involved in these, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for that kind of confrontation. And it gets to that point, then something really horrible can happen. But what they're banking on is what happened, I think, in Nevada, which is the federal government looked across the lines at those some of those militia folks with their sniper rifles and said, this is going to be a disaster and people are going to get killed. We can't do this. I mean, when it gets to that point, you know, something's already gone wrong. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that happens again.
George, so what do you do with the Cliven Bundy? I mean, he's shooting off his mouth this week, which is hurting his cause. But he calls it civil disobedience. Others have labeled him a patriot. What do you do?
Well,
how can the government win in this?
Well, one, Thoreau would cringe at the idea that Cliven Bundy is engaged in civil disobedience. Civil disobedience in the American lexicon is you think that a law is wrong, you violate the law, you get arrested, you go to prison, and by your example, you show the rest of the world, hey, this law is wrong. The government is being mean to me, and by my example, you should realize that this law is wrong and should be changed. Cliven Bundy and his militia have the idea that they're not subject to federal law. They go out of their way to say they don't recognize federal law. They don't recognize federal ownership of the land that he's been running his cattle on for 20 years at no charge when all the other ranchers have been paying their grazing fees. Now, he self-destructed the other day when he started making these racially tinged comments. And, you know, the internet was ablaze with, see, we told you. Conservatives are all racist. Conservative land militias are all racist. We knew this was going to happen. So why is anybody surprised by this? Well, I don't know if that's fair, but that's certainly what caused Cliven Bundy to self-destruct, you know, as the face of the Western Lands Movement. Now, Governor Herbert, to his credit, also criticized the idea that people should be taking up arms, that Americans should be pointing rifles at Americans. Some other people thought it was really cool when all those people showed up in camo and rifles and were threatening the federal government. And the federal government, to its credit, didn't want another Waco, didn't want another Ruby Ridge. So they backed off and gave the guy his cows back. And, you know, what do you do when you have somebody that's that recalcitrant, that immune to reason, but is making a star out of himself on TV? They're just going to have to wait him out, it looks like, and try and use more conventional methods back in court, find some way to order seizures and garnishments and things like that, which will be very difficult to enforce as long as he's surrounded by armed men.
His statements, though, Dan, really undercut what he was standing for. How much is this debacle going to hurt Republicans, particularly Tea Party supporters, going forward?
Well, those are the folks that most quickly came out and denounced and disavowed the comments, the racial comments of Cliven Bundy.
It was pretty funny. The hands off was like
it
immediate.
It was rapid. I mean, it was, you know, instantaneous. And folks who had been, you know, clearly wrapping their arms around this guy were just running in the opposite direction as fast as they can. Mm. And the Tea Party folks were among the leaders of that pack going in the other direction. So,
and how much is this going to affect the broader public lands discussion, do you think?
Well, I think the violent scene of these, you know, the scariest ones that I've seen were the photos of the militia guy up on the bridge above it all with the sniper rifle.
I think the caption said that he's got four in his sights or something like
that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a very small minority of people that aren't frightened by that picture. Let's hope it's a small minority of people who aren't frightened by that picture, because, you know, we don't want that. We don't want disputes resolved like that. And it's just sad that if it gets that way again.
Mm. George, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the decisions about what will be done with the public lands in the West will be made by Congress, which has many more representatives from Connecticut and New York and New Jersey and Florida than it does from Utah and Wyoming. I mean, the fact that Utah and Wyoming and Montana and Nevada are as influential in Congress as they are is only due to the original quota system in the Constitution that every state gets two senators, whether it's got more cows than people or not. The idea that Congress is going to give up vast swaths of public land is a total pipe dream, and the only reason to promote it is that it gets you votes at the Utah caucuses and conventions. It's just totally misleading people to think that there's going to be any chance that the federal government is going to give this up. It is a total fabrication to refer to those lands as Utah lands. It is a total fib to say we want those lands back when they were never Utah's lands to begin with. They were the Indians' lands, and then they were Mexico's lands, and now they belong lock, stock, and barrel to the federal government. The federal government owns those lands the same way you own your house and your car and your dog and your cat. Well, maybe not your cat, but it's a matter of ownership. And the idea that you can just wander onto these lands with your cattle and your rifles and say, this land now belongs to me, anybody who's promoting that is not qualified for any kind of leadership capacity.
Dan, you mentioned that there's an ATV sort of protest. We've seen various protests here and there. There is that other avenue of legislative change, and Representative Ken Ivory here in Utah is pushing something called the Transfer Public Lands Act, I believe it's called. Yeah. Do you believe, like George does, that has no chance of getting any traction?
It gets political traction in the West, and it gets political traction at gatherings of conservatives and Republicans, and that's an important thing, and politicians know that's an important thing. And so today, in 45 minutes, we're going to have another news conference by Ken Ivory and supporters talking about, this is the way to go. Now, they have not come out publicly and endorsed the Cliven Bundy style of confrontation. What they are promoting is the idea that through state legislatures, if enough of them pass these kinds of laws, they're going to put pressure on Congress. As George mentioned, that's where the power over these public lands really rests, to try to transfer it over. Congress is not going to do that, again, as George said, because of the numbers in Congress. And so then what happens when that effort fails, their strategy is to go to court. And I think, again, they lose in court. So, but this has been going on for years. It's been going on for decades. And it's been a very lucrative political tool for those that are propounding it. I don't see that going away anytime soon.
I want to move on. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We're talking about the week's headlines, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's move on to sperm, shall we? The University of Utah asked for an internal review of the activities of one of its former employees of a fertility clinic that they had association with a couple of decades ago. Matt Piper, you've been covering this. What are the allegations against this gentleman? His name is Thomas Ray Lippert.
Yeah, so Thomas Lippert worked at this U Community Lab in Mill Creek, which was sort of co-located and arguably in many ways the same thing as a private corporation that was run by some U faculty that was known as Reproductive Medical Technologies Incorporated.
So it wasn't directly a university department or anything
like that? Well, Tom Lippert was employed part-time by the university.
Okay.
And this lab was staffed exclusively by university personnel. And in 1991, this San Antonio couple went to this lab for artificial insemination treatments. And Tom Lippert they say he handled their semen sample, and then they took a take-home DNA test in October 2012, and it turned out that after some sleuthing, they figured out that Tom Lippert was the father of their daughter and not, as they had intended, the husband in the relationship. So, they contacted the U about that, and the U told them at the time that Tom Lippert worked for RMTI. And, through the months that followed, they sort of figured out that wasn't exclusively the case, that he also worked for the U. And, then in late January of this year, the U began a 90-day internal review of those allegations, and they don't dispute that it happened, that Tom Lippert is the father of their daughter Annie, but they were unable to determine that it was an intentional switch by Tom Lippert, who I should say had a criminal background and was convicted in 1975 of conspiracy related to a a widely publicized kidnapping.
Hmm. So this guy has some baggage. Mm-hmm. He was not given a background check when he was hired.
Correct.
He was a sperm donor, mm-hmm. and they knew about it.
Yes.
So the family's reaction?
The family's not pleased. And the family, it should be noted, is not pursuing at this time any kind of legal action or asking for any kind of damages. Their goal, their stated goal in this, was to raise awareness and to inform other couples who had been clients of RMTI and the Youth Community Lab that there's the potential that this could have happened to them too. And so what they're really not pleased about is the Youth finding in this investigation that the Youth should not make any special effort to contact former clients of the laboratory.
Interesting. I mean, how did this even happen? Was that a conclusion that came in the report? Was it a policy oversight? Was it a lack of oversight? What's going on?
There really aren't a lot of clear conclusions when it comes to what exactly happened. They just sort of said they couldn't rule anything out. And, you know, one thing, I talked to Jeffrey Botkin, who was on this special committee of three university physicians that looked into this, and he said, you know, Ronald Urey, who operated the lab and the use andrology functions as a whole, mm-hmm. he died in 1997, and RMTI was dissolved at that time. But Ronald Urey, you know, looking through some of his annual reviews and his notes, it seemed as though these labs were rife with problems. Mm-hmm. And some of those problems related to simple handwriting, bad handwriting on the samples, and just general paperwork errors. But there are indications that Tom Lippert was one of those problems, and nothing was done about it, at least until he separated from the U in 93 for unknown reasons. Hmm.
Talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Matt Piper about the sperm switch case that the University of Utah is currently wading through. If you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. And let's see, let's go to the phones. Lucy is joining us from Salt Lake City. You've been holding for a bit. Lucy, thanks so much for your patience.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I have a son who was fortunately conceived through sperm donation at the University of Utah. I'm troubled by this whole committee thing because it's all internal, and furthermore, Dr. Chero did not sign the report, and furthermore, Professor Chero, the professor of ethics, indicated to me that she was not an investigator, and apparently she only improved the ethical thought behind the report. So this was totally investigated by an internal committee of employees who, whether they know it or not, their jobs were on the line. The problem is they didn't interview Jane Jeremenko, the manager of the clinic at the time, nor did they interview Pam Urey, the spouse of Ronald Urey, who headed up the andrology clinic. And it's kind of been brushed aside, the fact that Dr. Urey committed suicide in 97, which coincidentally was 2 months after I informed him that my son had seizures and that should be noted on the sperm donor's number. Hmm. None of this has been addressed. There is a big cover-up going on. Dr. Carroll should not be taken at his word. He was totally involved in the report. The numbers that he suggests that are now children of Lippert do not add up according to anything that I'm aware of or have read.
Lucy, let me interrupt and just get Matt Piper's response, because you're presenting a lot of information. Matt, can you shed some light on some of the things that she's brought up?
Yeah, well, let's start with Dr. Chero. I spoke with her last night, and she had not read the final copy of the report. That is sort of the used ticket here to being able to say that this wasn't purely an internal investigation. They have this outside ethicist. And she did say that it is only the ethical considerations of this report that she was asked to weigh in on. And her role in the report was to first sort of approve, or not approve, but to review the policies that were going to sort of govern the process of this, and then to review the first draft of their final report. So, for the U to sort of insinuate, which I don't know how strongly they had, but for the U to bring her into this as a strong major part of this investigation, that may be a little bit of a stretch. I mean, the caller is correct that this was not something that was signed off on by her. And there is also a valid concern that the U.S. investigators have acknowledged that they did not interview some key players in this. And the reasoning behind that is still a little unclear. Jane Jeremenko was the office manager for the U.S. andrology operations, and she was never interviewed. Jane's upset that her personnel file was pulled as a result of this investigation, but for some reason she was never spoken to. Pamela Urey is actually listed as one of the people who was interviewed as a result of this investigation, but she was spoken to by Linda Burry, formerly Linda McReynolds, who was a principal of RMTI. So there may have been a conflict of interest there. And then Douglas Carroll, Douglas Carroll hasn't responded to numerous requests for comment. I'd really love to speak with Douglas Carroll, but Douglas Carroll was in a supervisory position at the U at the time that Thomas Lippert worked at this community laboratory. And, there is very little mention of him in the report, and he's never been made available to the media. So it would certainly be interesting to know what Dr. Carroll knows.
Well, Lucy, it sounds like you're unsatisfied. What more do you want? Do you want an outside investigation? How do you think the university should proceed at this point?
Well, yes, I think it needs to be an outside investigation. I actually offered my input, and apparently that was never provided to the committee. I offered it through two channels. And the committee sort of put on blinders. They talk about mortality of possible siblings or half-siblings marrying and conceiving, but they don't even think or mention anything about the morbidity or the disease or illness or disability problems, only if a child were to die. And I don't think our community is that naive to accept all of this. So definitely an independent committee, and because there's factual information of conflicts, I was told that all of the records involving my donor number were burned, and I was told this in 97, 2 months before Dr. Urey committed suicide.
There's plenty to this story, Lucy. Thank you so much for calling. And clearly, we're going to continue to cover this. George Pyle, the university has apologized. Is that enough?
Well, it would seem really clear that they really need to have a proper outside investigation of this. This is just another example of the whole medical profession. This is a particularly sexy, sensational example of this, but we all put our lives in the hands of the medical profession, people who do things we don't understand, people who do things that we can't understand. They're the specialists. They do these things. The fact that all of these sorts of things, whether it's, hip replacement or ankle replacement or artificial insemination, we spent a lot of money on this. We're arguing about who's going to pay for it and who's going to be included in insurance. One of the big things, problem with the advances we've made through Obamacare and Medicaid expansion, is that we really haven't got a handle on the cost of medical care. If we're going to get a handle on the cost of medical care, it's going to have to be better overseen. It's going to have to be better reviewed. Now, that in itself costs some money and bothers some doctors because it means that they have somebody looking over their shoulder all the time. But we're going to have to do a better job of looking over the shoulder of all kinds of medical professionals, not just those that are involved in this sort of sensational activity.
Mm. Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is with us, also reporter Matt Piper and government editor Dan Harry. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, and you can join us as well. The number is 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporter Matt Piper, editorial writer George Pyle, and government and politics editor Dan Harry. And you're invited, too. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or you can call us. And that number, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Let's turn to another report. Seems like this is a report-heavy week. An internal review by the Attorney General's office this time, saying that the behavior of former Attorneys General Mark Shurliff and John Swallow, when it came to crossing ethical lines, they said it defied logic. And we've had a lot of reports when it comes to the AG's office. Dan Harry, can you just fill in the gaps? Tell us more about this particular report.
Yeah. You know, another case of spending a lot of money to come to a conclusion. You kind of already knew that a lot of what those two did was inexplicable. This was a look at the case on the Attorney General's office dealings with Mark Jensen, who was convicted on securities violations. I want to be careful about how I phrase that. You know, it's often shorthanded as fraud, but the convictions were on securities violations. So he is in prison right now, and he's awaiting trial on different criminal charges. But in the meantime, he's claimed that his case should be thrown out, that it should be re-adjudicated from the beginning because of the mistakes and conflicts, and as he calls them, shakedowns by the two former attorneys general. And the report just basically, as you said a lot of things here were inexplicable. There were close personal contacts between Mark Shurliff and Mark Jensen, including after his conviction. There were two trips to his luxury villa in Newport, California, which, you know, anybody who's in public office and is doing that, you slap your forehead and you say, what in the world were you thinking? And that's kind of the crux of what this report said.
Well, the current AG, Sean Reyes, asked for the report. Yeah. What's he going to do with it?
Well, it seemed kind of like an invitation to go along with what Jensen's attorneys have suggested, which is that you know, the court look at this and determine, you know, hold evidentiary hearings and determine whether some of these things were so out of line that they should be given a second look by the court. So, you know, it kind of looks like that's where this is going. I'm not a legal expert, but that's what it looks like from the outside.
And I understand that Mark Shurliff refused to be interviewed by these internal reviewers. How is he responding to what they came up with?
Well, he just kind of reiterates, as he always had, that he's innocent of any wrongdoing, that he's looking forward to the day when he has no criminal investigation hanging over him so that he can tell the real story. You know, that's...
So he's constrained by current investigations.
Yeah, that's what he said. Saying. He okay. wouldn't talk to them because of the current criminal investigation that's going on with Sim Gill and Troy Rawlings.
Okay. So, yeah. That's our weekly Attorney General update. Okay, let's move on to party conventions. This weekend, Democrats, Republicans getting together to party.
Yes, they are.
Let's start with the GOP. What are some of the things that our reporters are going to be looking for?
Well, the big races are congressional races, and all four of them are up, and all four of them have contested races. And it's hard to get really excited about them. you know, we think we know who are the clear front runners in most of these races.
Okay, tick them off for us.
Well, the big one to watch is the 4th Congressional District. That's where Jim Matheson, the Democrat, is stepping down. And so the Republicans have a real good opportunity to pick up that seat. And a lot of them are banking on Mia Love. Mm-hmm. If elected to that seat, she will become the first black Republican woman in Congress. And unlike people talking about Cliven Bundy being the face of public lands, they would Republicans would really like Mia Love to be the face of Republicans in the House of Representatives. But she is challenged. Bob Fuhrer, who's a former retired business executive, largely self-funding his campaign, is challenging her. And Chris Stewart, the first-term congressman, also has a challenge, but again, is looks like he'll be win the nomination and has a good chance of continuing in that seat. Third District, Jason Chaffetz has a challenger. Again, you know, very little funding, very little name ID, and it seems going into it like a very little chance of losing. And Rob Bishop is also being challenged.
So, as usual, incumbents have
incumbents have
the floor.
A big, big advantage going in, yeah.
Okay. What about the Democrats? They've got some big decisions to make. They need a new party leader.
Yeah, that's one of the highlights of the Democratic convention is choosing a new chairman. Jim DeBacchus, who's served in that role, stepped down for medical reasons. He's going to continue running for his Senate seat, but he said that the job as party chairman just takes up too much time, and so he's stepping down from that. Peter Caroon, the former Salt Lake County mayor, is running for that, as well as Richard Davis, a BYU political science professor. And, you know, it's, you kind of look at that and you go, why would anybody in the world want that job in this state? But these two guys do, and they're very competent, articulate, capable guys. So that will be an interesting race.
Are there any other races where Democrats have an edge or a chance?
Well, in some of the Salt Lake County legislative races, Democrats are very strong within Salt Lake County. And so, you know, you see some legislative seats. Janie Iwamoto just beat Ross Romero at the recent county convention for Pat Jones's Senate seat. Mm-hmm. And they probably have an edge in that and some other legislative races. But, you know, in the congressional and the higher races, Democrats are pretty much the underdogs. So
that's an understatement.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the University of Utah. The University of Utah's Student Senate voted this week, right, to change the words of the Utah fight song. They had phrases like Utah man instead of Utah fan, fairest co-eds, a few outdated phrases in there. What were the arguments that won the day, Matt Piper?
Well, you know, I think the arguments were just that even if a majority of university students and alumni didn't favor changing the fight song, that even if a minority out there felt somehow that this fight song was making them feel unwelcome at the university, that was something that was worth considering. And that, you know, this is something that was, I think the president said he wouldn't recommend trying this again or something to anybody, because it's something that's obviously very hotly contested, and it's they sort of felt like they had an opportunity to do something for a minority of potentially a minority of students who feel that the fight song objectifies women and has a racial component with that line, the fairest co-eds.
Who decides? Who has the final say? Is it President Pershing?
President Pershing has the final say, and I think, you know, Lindsay Whitehurst, this is her story, and I've just been kind of a fascinated observer here, but I think he has the option to refer this to the Faculty Senate, and if he chooses to do that, then he can choose then later to take or not take their recommendation. You know, he's in a tough spot because there's really no win for him here politically. You know, you either shoot down the student government, which is sort of trying to modernize a fight song, and you're the latest male to be president of the University of Utah. Never had a female president. Or, you know, you risk infuriating a lot of very passionate Utah fans who have, you know, I think there was a rally up on campus yesterday, and, you know, Twitter was, locally Twitter was probably near crashing because of the response to this this ASUU meeting, probably the most watched ASUU meeting in student government's history. So he's in a tough spot, and either way, he's going to have some critics.
George, people care about this issue. They care passionately.
Well, it's tradition. You know, you don't stomp on tradition, even if tradition is arguably sort of silly. At my high school commencement, we were all supposed to stand up and sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And over in my corner, just to be contrary, we sang God Save the Queen, because the tune is the same and the words are different. So, you know, when they stand up at a football game and sing the fight song, I mean, there are going to be people who sing the new words and people who sing the old words and people who make up their own words and people who put all kinds of nasty things into it. Because they want us, they don't want us, because some people think Utah Man is sexist, and you know, it's an old song, and it man was meant to be inclusive. Also, when they say the coeds are the fairest, in that archaic construction, fair doesn't mean white, it means pretty.
Sure,
but
words change meanings.
Words
over
change
time.
Meanings
they
over
sure
time.
Do.
Well, there are, you know, songs where they have the word "gay," which means happy, and it doesn't mean that to a lot of people anymore. So yeah, words change and meanings change. I think, you know, this is one of those things that student government talks about because they don't have a lot of meaningful decisions to make because they aren't allowed. So this is how they practice. This is how they practice being politicians later on, is by by raising issues and ticking people off and finding themselves in a no-win position. And then this old white guy who's the president of the university has to try and negotiate his way out of it.
So where's your money on Pershing's decision? What's he going to do?
Boy, I bet he wishes there was a way he could punt. I don't know who he'd punt to.
At least we haven't seen any sniper rifles.
No, they're circling the bridge or the stadium and saying, "Well, you'll take the Utah man out of my cold dead hands." but I don't. I'm sure he wishes that nobody had brought this up. He's got. I mean, this has been a bad week for the university. They've got the sperm donors. They've got the nurse who was fired for making racist Facebook comments. They've got this. Sooner or later, you know, somebody ought to probably go to class and learn something. but you know, the semester's over, so I don't really see it as a huge deal one way or another. I think that he'll probably wind up changing lyrics, and when people stand up and sing the song, they'll sing whatever damn words they want.
Talking about the week's news, and we invite you to chime in as well. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Matt Piper, political editor Dan Harry, and editorial writer George Pyle. And you, of course, are invited to join us. 801-355-TALK. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's talk sports, shall we? it seems like we've been talking a lot of policy stuff. The Utah Jazz are under reconstruction. It turns out this week the management decided to show Ty Corbin, the head coach, the door at the end of his contract. Not really unexpected, given the painful season that we've had to witness. But what reasons did the general manager, Dennis Lindsay, give? Matt Piper.
Well, you know, I think it's just that he was in an impossible spot. The general manager of the Jazz, Dennis Lindsay, sort of set this team up for failure by handing out huge contracts to Andres Biedrins and Richard Jefferson in the offseason prior. And he did that, with the intention of having a bunch of salary cap room this season. And potentially, many fans would argue to have a really bad team that would then get a really good pick in the next draft. Mm. And the guy who bears the brunt of that is Tyrone Corbin, who nonetheless his job was to win games this season. So he was really put in a spot where no one was going to be happy with him. When the Jazz won, people were upset. And when the Jazz lost, people were upset. So, you know, I think Tyrone Corbin, and this is just sort of my personal opinion, I think he probably leaves this job as one of the most well thought of recently fired coaches in recent months. You know, I mean,
everyone. The title that all coaches try.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think he'll land in an okay spot. But I think for Dennis Lindsay, the problem became that he had a coach here for a few years who didn't win a lot of games. And that, you know, maybe he was in the danger of having sort of a losing culture on his hands unless he brought in a new coach.
Was he purely a victim of circumstance, though, or were there some shortcomings on his part?
Well, there's some criticisms of Tyrone Corbin, as there are of, you know, any coach. In Corbin's case, the criticisms were that he didn't play young guys enough. Others would say he played young guys too much. You know, there were a couple guys, Enes Kanter and Derek Favors, who he stopped playing together as much as he had previously early in the season. And some fans said, well, hey, those are cornerstone pieces of our franchise, and if they can't play together, then we've got a problem. Mm. But if you lose more than 50 games, fans are going to have a lot of criticism. So I don't know that it was really one thing that Dennis Lindsay could point to and say, this is the way in which, you know, Corbin failed us.
Mm. George, what do you think?
Well, yeah, the guy was put in an impossible situation. It was what they call a rebuilding year. It happens in all sports. It happens at the college level. It happens at the pro level. A year when you go into it thinking, well, you know, we're not really contenders. We're not really in a chance to win a championship. So let's bring in some new guys. Let's let some young players get some experience and build for the next year, and in this case, get a draft pick. I mean, the weird way the NBA works with the draft is so important. I mean, you know, it's important in all sports, but basketball, where you've only got five guys on the floor at a time, and one person can make a huge difference, more so than in baseball, more so than in football. And so they're put in a situation where their own fans want them to lose games so that they'll have a better lottery pick. Now, the NBA has kind of put a curveball on that, and the fact that the team with the worst record doesn't automatically get the first pick. They have this lottery. And if you have the worst record, you get more ping pong balls in the drum, and you have a better chance of having an early pick. And even if you finish second worst, you have a pretty good chance of getting a pretty good player. There's a bunch of one-and-done freshmen in the college ranks that are coming out that the NBA general managers are just salivating over, and one of those may be at Energy Solutions Arena next fall signing autographs, and we'll all be happy to have them. But, boy, you know, reversing the fortunes, you know, with one player, even a superstar, that's a lot to ask. And whoever gets to be the coach is going to be expected to turn this around really fast, and I don't know if that's a fair expectation.
Who is on the short list, Matt Piper?
Well, you know, I don't know how qualified I am to say that, but one guy who is mentioned who has connections with Dennis Lindsay, in that at least Dennis Lindsay came from San Antonio, and this guy was at San Antonio last year, is Jim Boylan, former University of Utah coach.
And he's got some baggage.
He's got some
him.
Baggage here, locally. He's very, very well thought of pretty much everywhere else. But if he were to come to Utah, and, you know, I think he could win 20 straight games, and then if he lost two in a row, people would be calling
trouble,
for
huh?
his head because of his struggles with the running Utes.
Yeah, well, what does he think about the fight song? That's what we're
Does the political editor have anything to add?
No, I was just saying before the show started that the Jazz to me now are like the January inversion.
Long forgotten.
How
quickly we forget. Let's move on to our final segment, which is the underplayed story of the week, sort of a sleeper story that you think there was a lot of headline news this week, maybe have gotten under the radar. And Danny Harry, what's your pick?
Well, one that didn't quite get under the radar, but got some coverage, was the aesthetics of the new federal courthouse building, which is, you know, from a non-professional viewpoint, very beautiful in the inside and horrible on the outside. architects, Jim Dalrymple wrote a story about architects thinking it's a wonderful structural piece of art. But I think normal people look at that and just, they cringe.
I kind of think it looks like the Apple store in Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of sterile.
Yeah, it's very sterile. And, you know, one of the things that, didn't get mentioned in this in the stories about it were that it has no name. You know, politicians love to name federal buildings. Most of them have names. And the old federal courthouse, which is a beautiful old structure, is the Frank Moss Courthouse. Well, the new building doesn't have a name because it's got a reserved name on it, and that's Orrin Hatch. But they can't name it for Orrin Hatch while he's still in the Senate.
Ah.
And so that building, that ugly building, is going to sit there until after the 2016 election, waiting for the title to be bestowed on it.
And
well, maybe
addition,
he doesn't want to have. Maybe
he does want it. Trust me.
But
he,
if everybody thinks it's an ugly building, maybe he doesn't want his
name.
Well,
he does want it. And there was a contest a year or so ago that George Sutherland, the only U.S. Supreme Court justice from Utah. Mm-hmm. There were attorneys that got the Utah legislature to pass a resolution supporting that as the name of the building, and they passed it with very strong support, and it immediately fizzled because no one is going to go against Orrin Hatch, who wants his name on that building.
So in addition to some mixed reviews on its looks, it also had a very tragic first day with a shooting there.
Yeah.
And so, boy, it's already gone through the ringer. Okay.
The building with no name.
The building with no name is your story of the underplayed story of the week. Matt Piper, what you got?
Well, I'm calling that building the Borg Cube for now, by the way.
Doesn't look like it's finished. They tell us it's finished. I don't...
Just a bunch of concrete and dead trees and in this weird cube in the middle. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm sorry. Kyle Goon wrote today about the NCAA changing some of its policies or considering some changes to give the Big Five conferences a little bit more say in what they're able to offer athletes. That could have some major implications here for all the big schools. University of Utah, as a Pac-12 member, would then have the option, or the Pac-12 would have a little bit more autonomy to offer athletes some extra benefits, like insurance for after they're done playing, the ability to bring in family to see them play, increasing stipends. And so then the question becomes, what does that mean for the other schools?
Hmm.
You know, will BYU, which doesn't have a conference, at least in football, or, you know, will Utah State then be disadvantaged because they're not able to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak? So I think that's a story to watch sort of in future months and years.
Okay, awesome. George?
Well, what's really interested me this past week is in the past couple of weeks, we've had Ezra Klein's Vox, Nate Silver's 536 or whatever the hell number it is, 538. I got to look up what that means, then maybe I could remember it. And the New York Times now has their own vertical, the Upshot, I think. And they've all these media people are getting all this money to go online and do what they call explanatory journalism or data journalism. Think of new ways to explain all of this to it. And this may be, it's not like it's underreported because the media is going nuts over watching this stuff internally. But these are things to watch and things where, you know, your hometown newspaper may be able to learn some things. It's just a question of, again, whether there's enough money out there to make these profitable enterprises. But the demand, apparently, for better information apparently is out there.
That's good news for us.
It could be.
We've only got a couple seconds left. I'm going to put in a plug for school grading. Giving schools a grade, a letter grade, rankles so many teachers and those in the education community, but lawmakers seem to love it. And the governor's education advisor sort of offered an olive branch, a halfway midpoint plan this week. It'll be interesting, I think, to see what comes of that. So we'll leave it there. George Pyle, Dan Harry, and Matt Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you all so much for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And we'll wrap up today's program with a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who laments that it's bug season.
I have an ongoing battle with bugs. It's a lifetime conflict. And I'm especially annoyed with wasps because they gather on the playground equipment for my kids or for my grandkids and in my shed. And a number of years ago, I think it was in 2001, I found a wasp nest up in the rafters of my tool shed, that was the size of a waffle.
Ooh.
It was huge and had these wasps all over it, and so I thought I'd do battle with it and try to get rid of it before somebody got stung. But in the process of doing that, somebody did get stung a lot.
Uh-oh. Let me guess. you wrote a column about this. So.
Yeah, if you're ever going to try to get rid of wasps, don't use a shop vac. You know, I sucked all the wasps off the outside of the nest, but in the process of going down through the hose and into the canister, it didn't kill them. All it really did was make them angry. And so when I took the top off to get rid of the wasps, they came out ready for a fight. And we got into a bit of a one.
Oh, my. Do you want to read part of this column from 2001?
The good news is that it's not yet against the law to kill wasps, hornets, yellow jackets, or even the more common giant expletive deleted with huge stingers. For purposes of killing, please do not confuse the common honeybee with wasps. Bees are good. They belong to a union. Without them, there would be no expensive Honey Nut Cheerios. Note, do not confuse regular bees with killer bees, which scientists tell us are bees that have joined a gang.
That's great. That's great. So, no shop vac.
No shop vac.
How do you attack these wasps today?
I go get wasp killer like a normal person would from the store. Don't use fire. Don't use a shop vac, and don't just knock it down with a shovel because they'll come after you.
Maybe you could use your cannon.
I never thought of that. That's a good, yeah.
It might do some other damage, but.
Yeah, put a hole in the roof for sure. But the wasps would be gone. And then I'd only have to contend with something else that's even worse when it's mad, and that's my wife.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. He joins us each week with the best from the archive, and you can find all of his columns on our website, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.